This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Good morning. Our topic for this morning is Israel, a holy land. It's not just an arid philosophical issue, although it's interesting on that level, but it has a lot of implications for everyday Jewish life. The discourse of whether something is holy and what that means is actually in the paper all the time, even if one doesn't recognize it as such. So a lot of what I call line item arguments, in other words, specific issue arguments, once you trace them back, can be seen to be a part of this meta issue of whether people consider something holy. And I'll offer two examples before we begin to ponder. One, of course, is the ongoing issue of the relationship between Israel and its neighbors, and the question of whether land can be traded, negotiated, given up, etc., because of its holiness. And here I speak not of some sort of pragmatic political issue, like if the Israelis and Palestinians could actually sit down and trust one another, etc. I'm actually speaking about something larger, which is, what if they could? Would they give up the land anyway? In other words, there are certain people whose ideological predisposition would say that regardless of whether we have, quote unquote, a partner for peace, it is actually not allowed to trade one clot of earth of the Holy Land. That's just one ramification politically. And another one, of course, is an issue that has percolated through the newspapers in the last few days, which is the one that pertains directly to Ezra and Nehemiah, which is the status of the temple and the wall, so to speak. The wall itself, of course, is just an outer retaining wall built by King Herod, and yet it has accumulated an enormous amount of holiness baggage to the point where you have almost a worldwide Jewish crisis just on that issue. I'm not going to talk about either of those things this morning in detail, but I'm going to talk about the kinds of deeper issues that spring out and create those kinds of crises again and again and again. I'm going to ask everybody to turn down or turn off their cell phones before we begin. Right? In terms of this issue pertaining to the text that is the core text of the week, much of Ezra and Nehemiah is actually solely devoted to the idea of the rebuilding of the temple, because as you know, historically, what occurred was that the Jews were exiled after the destruction of the first temple by the Babylonians, and Ezra is leading a kind of action back to the land. And in fact, the book contains many issues that are of direct interest to contemporary Jews, including the relationship between Israel and the diaspora, the question of how many people actually want to go back to Israel. We'll talk about a little of those kinds of things, intermarriage as well. We'll talk about that in the second class I'm offering today. Let's begin with the notion of holiness as it pertains to a rock structure, a brick structure. There are, of course, historically many people who are skeptical of the holiness of what is, after all, stones. The notorious, infamous Yeshaya Leibowitz once labeled the Western Wall the discotel. I think he was trying to, in his inimitable style. Yeshaya Leibowitz, right? Nechama's older brother, philosopher, biochemist, very interesting thinker, talking about all of the kind of accoutrements that attend to what's going on, what is, after all, a stone wall. And literarily, some of you might reference Philip Roth's 1985 novel, The Counterlife, where there's also a kind of puzzlement about what's the big deal about a bunch of rocks. But there is a big deal about a bunch of rocks, at least in Jewish texts. And let's take a look at source number one. The philosophical question is whether God actually resides in a particular space. This is not an unimportant question. After all, if God is everywhere, God is one, all of the basic philosophical tenets of Judaism, then what difference does it make where you are? Why is God, quote unquote, more available in Israel / Jerusalem / the Old City / the Temple Mount than he is in Omaha or Fiji or anywhere for that matter? Isn't this a kind of nonsense? Isn't it a non sequitur? How can God even be contained in a particular space? These discussions emerge very early once the Jews form a national polity. They emerge in Sefer Shemot in Parsha Truma, where after having exited from Egypt, there is a discussion about building a tabernacle. And if you see there in source number one, here is a discussion by Don Isaac of Abarbanel, the 15th century Spanish thinker, who was the finance minister in Spain at the time before he was expelled with his sisters and brothers in 1492. And he writes the following in source one. Why did God command us regarding the construction of the Mishkan, this was the portable tabernacle in the desert, saying, I will dwell among them as if he were a defined corporeal being limited in space, when the exact opposite is true? He is not corporeal, nor material force. So how did they ascribe to him a place? Isn't that ridiculous? We're going to give God a house to dwell in. That's like saying we're going to give the air a house to dwell in, right? Did God not say of himself, the heaven is my throne, the earth is my footstool? Where is the house that you would build for me, and where is the place of my rest? Right? So this was a question that really did exercise many people in Jewish history, which is, what's the point of doing this? How can you actually contain the divine in a space? Something that is alluded to again in Source 2 in Melachim, the heavens, even the highest heaven, cannot contain you, how much less this temple I have built. It's interesting, right? Because there's already a self-deconstructing rhetoric that's taking place even as they're building the temple. They're wondering themselves, what is the point of doing this? What is the object of this? So clearly, one could argue, I think accurately, that it's as much for humans as it is for God. In fact, it might be primarily for humans, the need to sort of create an entity which structures their worship of God. This, to me, is actually, beyond the topic of this morning, a very intriguing issue, especially when you think about contemporary worship. Let's compare Jews to Christians. Having taught Jewish studies in university for many years, I had occasion often to be teaching Jews, Christians, Muslims. And Christians, as we know, did something that I think is fundamental in the history of religion, which is they concretized God. Right? A maneuver, I'm not here to talk about whether you like it, you don't like it, believe, you don't believe, that's irrelevant. In other words, as a strategy, it's brilliant, because the notion of having something there, right? Often Jews are left with this dilemma as there are there, right? Because you get up, you pray, and the purity of Jewish monotheism, right? The invisible, ineffable, untouchable, incorporeal God, right, that which Judaism banks on, revels in, turns out to be a bit of an Achilles heel for many people's worship. Right, what am I doing? What is there? Christians solve this in some ways by creating the most basic metaphor possible, a fusion between heaven and earth, which is sexuality. Right, God mates, creates a son. That son becomes divine. Regardless of whether you think this is rubbish theology, as a point of just creating a contact point for people, right? Talk to Christians about their prayer experience and compare it to how Jews talk about their prayer experience. It's actually quite enlightening. I'm not here in Pardes to offer an advocacy for crossing the street and switching sides. I'm simply here to say that the question of whether God can be accessed in a Jewish sense, is primary here. You know, we give a lot of hoopla to the idea of creating a space for God, and even that is just a rudimentary way of contacting. So the building of a holy space is to create some sort of notion that there's a concrete manifestation of God here, even though God doesn't, in essence, really show up in the way an historical flesh and blood figure shows up in Christianity. So it's not just a kind of elitist philosophical notion. It touches on the very idea of what are we doing when we do Jewish. So this question percolates through the commentaries, trying to understand the paradox of containing the divine in space and calling that space holy. At any point throughout the morning, you can jump in, ask, complain, do whatever you like. Yes, sir.
Sorry you opened that up. All right.
Not at all.
And I may have missed this in the beginning. I apologize for being a few moments late. Have you defined what you mean by holiness?
Not yet. You missed nothing. No.
Didn't even try.
The question of what holiness, of course, is also up for debate. It turns out that in Judaism, it has a rather segmented definition, right? There are different ways of understanding it, but the technical definition that emerges out of Tanakh is actually a place that is separate, right? The rabbis defined that word, right, kuf dalet shin, hekdesh, as something set aside from the ordinary.
Could you write right? that on the board?
Sure. Thank you for the reminder.
That's when you say those letters, not everybody knows.
Yeah. So here you have this word, right, kodesh, right? And you can look at this and you can see, what are all the iterations of this in Jewish life?
Kaddish.
Kaddish. Right? Kaddish. So we have Kaddish.
Kiddish.
Kiddish.
We
have Kiddish. Let's get
Kiddisha.
You have Kiddisha. Kaddisha. Right? You have Kedesha. Right, a temple prostitute.
And right? Hekdesh.
Right, we have Hekdesh. We have Kiddushin. Mikdash. All of these iterations of holy, right? Kaddish, morning prayer, Kiddush, sanctification of the day, Kedusha, the prayer that you say, the repetition of the Amidah. Hekdesh is stuff set aside for the temple. You want to donate something to the temple, I want to donate this chair, it gets the name Hekdesh. Which means, going back to your question, that I can no longer use it, that it is set aside for quote-unquote holy purposes, and if I want it back, I have to redeem it, I have to pay it back, there's a whole system. Right? So it seems like, also, Kiddushin, what is Kiddushin? Kiddushin is the notion, and it's imbalanced in the Bible, that the woman is set aside, right? She is forbidden to all other people, because as you know, in the Bible, there's a kind of bit of a one-sided monogamy. In other words, men can be polygamous, but women have to have one husband. That's changed throughout the course of Jewish history, but in the first page of Tractate Kiddushin, when it talks about the word Kiddushin, the Tosafists, you know, over there, the school, the French school, about 1100 or so, talk about the fact that what it means is the woman is set aside for this man, she's forbidden to all other people. So there's something in this word, you know, we translate it holy. Holy is a funny word, it's almost meaningless. Like, what does it actually mean? So when you get back to a technical definition, it means that this is allowed for this and nothing else, right? And of course, Mikdash, which is the temple, right? The Beit HaMikdash. So a lot of iterations here. And the question is whether holiness is an absolute term, it's binary, all holy, no holy, or whether there are gradations of holy, 10%, 30%, and so on. It seems from the Mishnah, which you see in source 3, that there are actually what's called Eser Kedushot, right? Eser Kedushot Hein, Es Yisrael Mikudeshet Mikol HaAretzot, that the land of Israel is sanctified more than any other land. Looking at the language there, it does not say that the land of Israel is holier than any other land, right? If we're being precise. It says it's Mikudeshet, it's sanctified more than any other land. Right, which suggests that possibly things become holy only on what you do with them. Right, this is one of the major arguments in Jewish history: is holiness a basic ontological state, or is it something you create? Example: everyone talks about the holiness of the land of Israel. Is that holiness there inherently? Like every clod of dirt, every tree is just holy. Let's say, for example, no one lived here. No Jews, no Arabs. It was completely vacant. Would the land of Israel be, quote-unquote, holy? Nobody's doing anything here to sanctify it, right? If the answer to that, if one's answer to that was yes, then one has what is called an essentialist definition of holiness, meaning the thing in and of itself, almost in its DNA, is holy. And it doesn't matter what you do. But if you have a functional definition of holiness, meaning it's holy if I make it holy, right? If I sanctify it, then that's a very different thing indeed, right? One is talking about something that is inherent in the thing, and the other is talking about how I make it. So if Jews, for instance, think about this. If Jews do nothing to sanctify the land, let's play a bit. Every Jew in Israel decides to turn away from religion and lives peaceably, utterly secularly in the land. Is it a holy land? Does it get sanctified just because I go to the beach, eekly da, etc., etc.?
Essentialist, and what was the other?
Functional. And I'm an agnostic here. I'm not going to.
When there weren't many people in the land?
Right.
It had the potential at all points of being sanctified.
So we could also talk about that word, which I'm glad you used, right? Potential holiness, possible holiness, you know, there were enough people here. How does one even, you know,
gauge? I've got some wine in the cabin. I've got a cup there. It's like just waiting.
Right.
It's just waiting. It's
right.
Just
exactly.
Get it out.
Right. But what happens if it's never extracted? I never pour the cup. That kind of thing. Right. Go ahead.
Just to that point, if the wine is a kosher wine, it has no potential for that. And so there are certain lands that could have a potential to be sanctified to the point, and others that don't.
Right. You recall the kind of bizarre argument at the beginning of 20th century Zionism where, I think it's 1903, where Herzl posits the notion of Uganda as a possible land for the Jews. That directly interfaces with our topic, right? Uganda? That's not a holy land. Well, what if everybody just goes to Uganda and does Jewish in Uganda? Is it now a holy land? What if everybody's here and doesn't do Jewish? Is Israel holier at that point than Uganda? Yeah.
I think in a negative sense, it is holier because in two ways. One is that we're told that it'll spit us out if we do the wrong things. It's possible we don't have to do the right things. But if we do the wrong things, it'll spit us out.
Excellent.
And also the concept that when we're sent out, then it's going to make up for all the shemitahs that we missed. So the land itself kind of is deserving more of shemitah.
Right. So it's a possible container. And the example of spitting out is crucial, right? The notion that somehow the land has its own sensitivities, right? Yeah. What does that mean? How does the metaphor operate there? Excellent. Yeah, there was a hand for that.
We're talking about this contemporary conundrum without ignoring the historical significance which a lot of people put on it. So because of what happened here, I don't necessarily feel that way, but that is an argument that people look at Harbers and Harveyville, and they say, how can we? So there's this historical
good. Right. That's another. Let's start using names. What's your name, man?
Susan.
Right. So that's a category, right? What is the historical situation where Jews have been here and done things here? How does history, does history become holy? Does history sanctify a place, right? So these are all questions now up for grabs, right? Let's return to the Mishnah. Oh, sure.
Isn't the question really whether we have certain obligations within the land? The land itself doesn't change. If there's a different population here, they're not required to do anything different than, as opposed to we when we are here have certain obligations versus we when we are elsewhere have certain obligations with respect to the land and with respect to ourselves.
Right. What's your name?
Ari.
Right. So Ari's point, again, if I do those things, does the land become more? And if I don't do those things, does the land become less, or does it remain? In other words, the question here is whether the land ontologically is a holy place, whether I do something, I don't do something, or is it a place just in potential, right? In other words, what's your name?
Seth.
Seth's metaphor, right? There's wine, there's a cup, but until I pour it, there's no holy action going on here. That was the conundrum, really, that people were trying to work out. All I was saying at the beginning was it's not a kind of theoretical, arid theoretical issue. It actually impinges on so many kinds of negotiations that take place in this country, on the political sphere, on the religious sphere. What is your standing attitude to this idea of holy space or holy people, right? Are Jews chosen? Does that mean they're holier than? Does that mean they're better than, superior than, different than, right? All of these things.
Holy city.
Right. Holy city. Right. Right. Exactly. Finishing the Mishnah in 3. Right. So it says the land of Israel is mikudeshet, sanctified from all the lands. And now it says something very interesting. It attempts a definition. Umahi kdushata. And what exactly is this holiness? Shemivim imena haomer vabikurim ushte alechem masha'en mivim kain mikol artsu. Turns out it's not an ontological inherent definition. It's the stuff you do. What makes it holy? Because here you bring certain kinds of offerings that the Bible dictates that you would not do in Canada or in Holland, right? You're bringing the omer, you're bringing the two loaves, etc. Yes?
I think you could argue, though, that could be read as inherent, that it's the only land that has the potential for these.
Yes, you could, Carol, you could read it that way. And that's the argument. In fact, how do we read this? Rabbi Louis Jacobs gives a very fine definition of the issues that are pertinent here in 4. He writes, "It is hard to understand how the God whose glory fills the earth can be said to reside in one place more than another. Why is the building in which he's worshipped, more his house than any other spot on earth? Now, what meaning can be given to the idea that there are degrees of sanctity in which one place is more holy than another? Does this mean that there is a greater degree of indwelling in the holier place? And if it does, how can it be said that God is located more definitely in one spot, less in another?" Just to pause, this is a problem for Judaism, not for paganism, right? Judaism does certain things that maneuver it into a corner that give it problems. If you're polytheistic, if you're pagan, so you just chop up the universe into different domains, right? The god of the acorn, the god of the tree, the god of the wind, the god of fire, right? Also, this has direct bearing on other issues, let's say theodicy, right? If you have multiple deities, you can say this one is good, this one is bad, right? You see that in ancient religions like Persian Zoroastrianism, where you have a good god, bad god, siphoned in certain ways into Christianity, which has a certain dualism, Jesus, the devil, right? Talk to Christians about why do bad things happen, and some of them will simply say, it's the bad guy, right? Judaism does something revolutionary and actually religiously demanding, which is it says monotheism, pure monotheism, means everything is God. What you like, what you don't like, what you consider good, what you consider evil. There are no other forces to sort of blame or divert to. So the question here, how can God be somewhere else? So if you're pagan, you just say, well, of course, because that's the sun god. But if you're Jewish, you look at God and say, God is more in the temple than elsewhere. That sounds pagan. And in fact, it is pagan. It doesn't just sound pagan, it is pagan, right? So the question of how to negotiate that. Here is Jacob's rehearsal of different approaches to this problem. Yes, ma'am.
Renee, so what happens when there is no temple? When was the first exile? The Jewish crisis?
Right. We adjust.
Well, I know. Right. About 2,000 years, but I'm just saying, did people then do mass... like they just left the religion because there was no they couldn't do the religion?
Right, you're asking.
I mean, then they became prayer and da 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 da.
So it's a very important, it's fundamental what you're asking. And I'm not an historian, and I don't think we really have a. It's hard to get, there's no CNN in the ancient world. It's very hard to get a real on the ground sociological picture. We create a lot of myths about what people are actually doing and thinking, but. It is a crisis, right? There is an enormous crisis when the Second Temple is destroyed, especially, and doesn't come back, where people have to adjust their very vision of fundamental religious questions like, who is God? How do I access him? What does it mean to do Jewish things, etc.? And right, and there is this revolution, a remarkable revolution for the rabbis and still where they democratize Judaism, where through prayer and study and so on, you don't need the priestly caste anymore, you don't need this building, right? But it's a real shift, and I'm sure that for them it was an enormous change of consciousness. Just to think about another example, not our subject here, but what would happen if Jews were told prayer is rubbish, God doesn't need words, doesn't need this stuff, right? Just meditate. Sit in a room together in silence, and that, I realize that's completely impossible for Jews to sit in a room quietly for, forget about an hour, for 10 minutes. But, like, what if Jews were Quakers, right? Maimonides suggests such in the Guide. If you look in the Guide of the Perplexed, part 1, chapter 59, he says that praise to God is silence, right? That a really kind of advanced level of contact would not be all of this stuff. He goes on in 332 of the Guide to talk about sacrifice. It's just a concession to the ancient mindset. That's what they needed. And in fact, the real truth is that this is all very kind of crude ways of accessing God. So it's funny thing about the temple. You can either look at it as a disaster, or you can look at it as that is the destruction, or you can look at it as an opportunity, right? That through the, whatever you want to call it, the providence or the fate of history, you're offered an opportunity not to actually decline, but to go up the ladder. Now, if you think about just that idea, is not having it better or worse, and think about all of the intensity of discussion about the wall and the Temple Mount, and this is where God is, and we need it. And if we get it back and we make the space, we'll rebuild the temple. Are we going forwards or are we going backwards? Right. I just leave that as a question to ponder. But your question is central, right? What happens when you take this away? Well, for some people, it's incredibly anxiety-provoking, and we need to get back to it. And for other people, it's kind of like this is sort of the way it's supposed to go, and we're moving forward, right? Let's finish off Jacob's here. There are two different ways within monotheism. We're on source 4, line 7. Of understanding the concept of a holy place. The first is to see the divine as somehow actually located in a quasi-physical manner in the sacred spot, or better, as especially manifested there. Right? The second way is to see the holy place as hallowed by experience and association. Right? So there's your two views. God is there inherently. God is there when we bring him in, when we sanctify the place. Right? On this view, there is numinous power in the holy place, not due to any special indwelling of the divine, but due to the evocation of intense religious emotion, because the place has been the scene of, here comes history, the divine revelation, or of sustained and fervent worship. It is history that hallows the shrine. The problem that still has to be faced by all theists is, how can God be everywhere without the universe ceasing to be anywhere? Or conversely, if the universe is everywhere, how can God be anywhere? Right? This is a topic for a different time, but it is a key religious question. We're bound to conclude that statements such as God is everywhere are themselves spatial and can be no more than metaphors, right? So in fact, he says something I think that is very, very shrewd, which is, it's no more true to say that God is everywhere than it is to say that God is at the Temple Mount. They're both non sequiturs, actually. They're both just metaphors for something we don't understand. If God doesn't occupy space, then he doesn't occupy all space either. So that leaves us with whatever it is we want to do with this, but it's going to be hard to get to the philosophical truth, you know, of where God is. So let's summarize before we move on. In contemplating the problem of whether God is located in any particular space, and for our purposes, whether God is more in Israel than elsewhere, this summoned an argument that had a lot of shadings, but can be organized around two basic poles. One, the what I call the essentialist school. Things are inherently holy, right? Israel, Jews, etc. Versus the functional, or what you might call the acquired holiness school, right? Things, right? B become holy through sanctified acts. That's a crude thumbnail binary of the issue. When you look at the Middle Ages, at the discussion between medieval Jewish philosophers, you see this argument break down, and now, once you have the argument clear, you can plug in any issue you like. You can plug in whether Israel is holy, you can plug in whether Jews are chosen, you can plug in whether you should trade this piece of land for that thing, right? Any, in other words, one of the things I think is very important when we're learning Jewish is to get past the noise of the particular issue to the kind of meta-argument that underlies all of these issues, and we get clarity about them. Right? So here, we'll just take a look at the argument between Maimonides and Yehuda Halevi. Right? Maimonides and Halevi, both writing approximately in the 12th century. Their central texts are Standards of Jewish Philosophy. Halevi dies shortly after Maimonides is born. For Maimonides, it's the Guide of the Perplexed, which is published in 1190, right? And for Halevi, it's Kuzari, right? So we're not exactly sure when the Rambam is born. Some say 1135, some say 1138, but we know he dies in 1204. And Halevi, who's on this side, who's an essentialist, right, is 1075 to 1141. So they're in the same ballpark, right? There's a wonderful book by the former head of Jewish thought at the University of Haifa, Menachem Kellner, called Maimonides' Confrontation with Mysticism. And in there, he presents an excellent metaphor for understanding the issue of holiness. We're on source number 5 at the top of the next page. For Halevi, the mitzvot, the commandments of the Torah, reflect an antecedent reality, meaning something that's already there, already in place. Holiness, for example, is something which actually inheres in holy places, things, people, and times. The holiness is already in them before I even get there. Were we able to invent a holiness counter, right, it would click every time its wand came near something holy, just as a Geiger counter clicks in the presence of radioactivity, right? So that's a very good depiction of the essentialist school. I'm on the Lebanon border. I've got my holiness counter. Nothing's going on. Literally, I cross, it starts clicking. That's the essentialist community. Right? There's something there in it. Or I, you know, click towards the Jew as opposed to the non-Jew, etc., etc. Right? So there's something inherent, right, for the essentialists. Radioactivity, of course, is present in the physical universe, while holiness is present only in the metaphysical universe, as it were. But just as radioactivity can have effects, even though it's not apprehended by the senses, so also holiness can have effects, even though it cannot be apprehended by the senses. There really is something there, right? So that's the essentialist school. We are clear? Barur? Okay. In 6, Kellner goes on to point out that Maimonides held a different view of holiness. According to that view, holiness cannot be characterized as ontological or essentialist. Holy places, persons, times, and objects are in no objective way distinct from profane places, persons, times, and objects. So, holiness is the name given to a certain class of people, objects, times, and places, which the Torah marks off. According to this view, holiness is a status, not a quality of existence. It's something that you create, and then it has that label of holiness because you've set it aside. You've sanctified it, and it becomes holy. It's a challenge, not a given. It's normative, not descriptive. It is institutional, and this, I think, is crucial, in the sense of being part of a system of laws and hence contingent. Institutions, for Maimonides, create holiness, right? So the Jewish institution of law says that if you do that, it will become holy, right? So there's a kind of manual that's telling you this thing becomes holy if you follow the manual. So that's what he calls institutional holiness. It doesn't reflect objective reality. The Geiger counter doesn't go off just because you cross the border or wave it near a Jew. It goes off when you make kiddush, right? It goes off when you bring the omer, right? And so on. Holy places, persons, nations, times, and objects derive their sanctity from the roles they play. Let's look at the last three lines here. The uses to which they are put. Holiness, it follows, this is for the Rambam, must be institutional, a matter of halakhic definition, not ontological somehow actually in the universe. So it turns out that the halakha tells you what's holy. It says that's holy if you do that. If you make kiddush on Thursday night, you've done nothing. If you make it on Friday night, you've sanctified. So actually, the halakha as an institution is actually defining for you what it is that is holy or not, right? And much of what we think about in human life becomes institutionalized by legal systems, right? We don't think in terms of holiness in secular legal systems, but we do think in terms of right, wrong, permitted, not permitted, holy, you know, moral, immoral. Right. The institutions define what those things are for us. Yes, sir.
This is really helpful. Thank you. I mean, you made a comment about a third kind of thing of history, which it seems to me would be helpful with, and maybe you can explain, but I think Kellner is contracting two different ideas in how he's describing Maimonides. I would ask you which of these is Maimonides' view, if you know what I'll spell out, but the essentialist and tradition and functional arguments could be applied, say, to other social goods like money, right? Some people believe gold has a central value. Everyone knows that a dollar bill does not or a shekel does not. It's the use that it's made in a collective agreement that we have as a social good that creates a functional value in it.
Right.
But what I heard you say, which was really helpful in some of the texts, is that there's this other thing called history. That by the use of something, so it's not essential, it's functional, an object takes on and becomes, or it becomes an essentialist object. So which is it that Maimonides is viewing here? Does an object become holy through a social convention that functionally turns it into holy? Or is it always and must it always be a functional thing, and so when it is not done, it no longer is holy?
So that question is the advanced course.
it's a
wonderful question and what's your name?
Andrew,
it's a notoriously difficult question to answer, especially from a Maimonidean perspective, because it's his discussion of it is very slippery, and Kellner devotes a certain amount of time in the book to trying to pin down the discussion. On some level, you would think that history is functional. In other words, you would think that what Jews did sanctified the land. The question becomes whether once they've done it, does it remain now, and does it shift over that there's now a kind of, almost like a residue or stamp of holiness that now adheres.
The Geiger counter would go up because of what happened.
So it's an argument. It's really an argument about whether history now morphs into, because the difference is that if it's done, and then stops being done, right? So Abraham tried to sacrifice Isaac at Har Moriah, and the Jews built the temple. But now that's a long time ago. Nothing's happened since. Is it still a holy place? Does it have that residue out? The discourse is actually quite contradictory and conflicting about whether it leaves that, you know, it leaves that residue. And to just take it one step further, how do things maintain a status, right? Do you need to continuously infuse them, or can you just put them out and it goes? Think about, I mean, this will be bizarre, but I'm a lowbrow guy. Think about the difference between driving a car and running a bobsled, right? When you drive a car, your foot's on the gas. And if you take your foot off the gas, the car stops. In a bobsled, I mean, bobsled will stop, but the image of it is different, right? You got the guys in their cute little spandex at the top, and they're going like that, and they get in, and whoosh, and down it goes, and the illusion is that it's now going on its own. In other words, it had the initial push, and now it just goes. So what is the right metaphor for the holiness, let's say, of Israel? Is it we sanctified it, and now it's sanctified, right? Like a bobsled. I got in, I gave it the push, and now it's holy. Or is it like a car, you know? If I keep sanctifying, if I keep pressing on the gas, it will remain holy. And if I don't, it's just another place, right? That's actually something that is at the heart of so many arguments in this country about so many issues, like what is this place, right? What is this place? Even the notion of what that wall is, right? What is it? Is it a holy bunch of stones just because it was there a few thousand years ago and King Herod, who's not anyone's definition of like the greatest saint of all time, happened to build a sustaining wall? Or is it because, no, it doesn't matter what happened. Once they used it, it attaches itself to this incredibly holy activity and it's now holy forever, right? These things really never come up in the kind of noise of popular discussion, but it often occurs to me, like, what's the big deal? Why is everybody going crazy about this Sphinx, right? So the ideologies kick in. Yes, ma'am.
So I was thinking about Shabbat.
What's your name?
My name is Kelly.
Kelly.
So, you know, the Reformed Jews tried to define Shabbat on Sunday. So because time is hopefully fine, there's really no physical difference between Saturday and Sunday. So did that ultimately become suspect because of the intent, which the intent was to try and assimilate, or did it become suspect because it was ahistorical and it was disconnected from history? Or could Sunday be Shabbat?
Beautifully put, right? Beautifully put. It depends on what it is that you think confers a status, right? The Bible confers a status that was interpreted by people to mean Saturday. If you think about it, there's no Saturday, right, in the Bible. There's just Yom HaShvi'i, and it depends when you begin counting. If you begin counting on, you know, Tuesday, so Yom HaShvi'i is Monday, right? So there's what texts say, and there's the way we historically understood them, right? So obviously for Christians, Sunday became the holy day. There were a lot of politics involved in saying that, well, if you make Sunday the holy day, you're really doing this quasi-Christian thing. But in essence, the question there is whether we have an ontological definition of what is the Sabbath, or it's just an interpretive definition of what Jews decided that's the day. And this is the exact time, Friday, you know, from X time, even the parameters of that, even if you accept Friday night, Saturday, like when does it start, right? Is it sundown? Is it stars coming out? How far after, right? All of this pertains to the notion of what does holy time actually mean and who defines holy time? And so on some level, the Bible gives part of a definition of holy time and humans then pull it and make it other. So I imagine that if you made Sunday a holy day, and everybody in the Jewish people agreed with Sunday as the holy day, so some people would say that's perfectly fine, that's what Jews do, we institutionalize our definitions of holiness, and others would say, you're wrong, there's a status that's been conferred by God that's outside of our hands, right? That doesn't pertain to what we think or believe. And you can't change that. And that's how it is. This is a much, much, much larger discussion. It pertains to everything about how much authority do humans have to define text, play with text, say the text have changing value depending on shifting morals. Think about LGBT, right? You have one verse, Leviticus 18:22, that talks about what seems to be anal sex between men. Is that historicized? Is that then? Is that permanent? Is that out of my hands? Right? Speak to Haredi, Posek, about that. Even if they're very empathic to the individual and their attitude will be, there's nothing I can do about that. I didn't create that definition. That comes from somewhere else. That comes from on high. I may feel horrible about it, but it is what it is, right? Speak to somebody who says, all things are interpretable, changeable, flexible, usable, what Jews do, and they'll say, yeah, I understand there's a verse there, but there are other verses that we change. But then the real kicker is, if you do change it, maybe you should change everything. And if you change everything, what's left? Right? That's the hardest one. The hardest one is I may feel bad about this, that, or the other, and I may say, we don't think like this now. And so now, why should I stop there? Why not just say, I don't like the way Sabbath, Kashrut, Brit Milah, the whole kit and caboodle. So that's where you end up with that kind of argument. But your point is extremely well taken. You know, what is Sunday? Right? It's the same kind of paradigm, the same sort of problem. Right? That's the medieval argument.
I'm really worried now.
Sorry?
I want a black and white course from you.
Oh, you came to the wrong place. Wow.
I'm getting really worried.
Wow. I'm the king of gray. I think all of life is gray. My wife is a psychologist, said that. What does it mean to be an adult? It means to tolerate ambivalence.
To tolerate?
Ambivalence.
Ambivalence.
Right?
Yeah.
To learn to understand that things are often complex and gray. And Judaism is no different, I would think. Yeah. Seth.
No, I'm all
right. Just no, I mean... Did you have your hand up before? Did I miss you? I'll get you one sec.
Yesterday, Ed and I were talking about the Kotel. And I said, look, Ed, it's not critical to get changed. It's not an obligation for a Jew. They have to pray at the Kotel. Ed said, for an American Jew, it's essential.
Yeah, but I meant it in their minds.
Yeah, I understand perfectly.
The situation, it's like...
In our minds, yes.
Yeah, so he said, it is an essential point. You know, and I said, I'd let it go because it's not an essential point. I could pray somewhere else in Israel. It'd be great to go to.
I hear.
It'd be holy.
Right. You know, it's like the fiddler on the roof, right? He says, like, you're right. You're right. You can't both be right. You're right. Ari.
You know, we have the ability as Jews to commission and decommission our own holy places as well. We commission synagogues and we decommission synagogues.
Yes.
We do rites and break our own and we bury some We change the dates of holidays depending on how it fits our calendars and connects with other days. Is there something different in the analysis that you're proposing about Israel and the borders of Israel being something that's non-decommissionable? As opposed to all of those others.
Beautifully put. That's really nicely put. And the answer is, depends who you're talking about. That's what I said at the beginning. Almost every line item issue comes back to certain kinds of crucial, defined arguments. Right? So there's two kinds of arguments that we're rehearsing here. One is that in all areas of Jewish life, you come back to this binary argument about whether something is essential or something is acquired. The second binary, which is it Kelly? Kelly and I were talking about, is that you have a fundamental perplexity in the history of religion between what is eternal and permanent and what is changeable and flexible. And you have a big conundrum, because everyone wants to feel like there's a there. They don't want to feel like their ethos is just shiftable, because if it is, then it's lightweight. On the other hand, everyone wants to feel that the religion is relevant to their life, that it isn't espousing an ethos that's 2,000 years out of date. It is not a simple matter to reconcile these two things. We'd like to think it is. We'd like to think that it's just, we'll make some changes, we'll update it, moderns will be happy. But there's a loss, there's almost a silent loss of gravitas that comes with this. And really, truthfully, the best expositor of this was Nietzsche. When Nietzsche, in the passage in which the madman comes into the marketplace and says, God is dead, which is in his book, The Gay Science, I think it's 1882 maybe, what Nietzsche is talking about there is a tragedy, right? In other words, God is dead. Why? You've killed him. Why? Because you're completely indifferent to the metaphysical now. He's talking to these like rational bourgeois burghers in Germany. And they think he's nuts, right? They mock him. But from Nietzsche's point of view, he is dead, but there's a tremendous ambivalence that comes with that. On the one hand, Nietzsche then uses that as the superstructure for a new way of thinking, right? The Übermensch, the will to power, etc. But if you read the passage, there's tremendous pathos. Like, he's telling them, you act as if God is dead, which means you don't seem to understand the implications of this, which is that all morality now is relative. Everything is up for grabs. And he's utterly stunned by their lack of why aren't you crushed by this? Why doesn't this keep you awake at night? Do you realize what you've done? It's like a new world, and you're just very sort of easy with it, as if it has no implications. When we in Judaism talk about making changes, even important changes, even ones that, let's say, we need to do, but there's a huge price that comes with change, and there's a huge price that comes with remaining static. So every step of the way, every change you make, is informed by, on the one hand, you want to feel like there's this founding kind of mythos that you want to keep, and on the other hand, you need to respond to people. Think about American law. It's always been, I'm Canadian, by the way. You talk about money. In Canada, it's a joke. You drop a dime on the ground, and by the time you pick it up, it's worth 7 cents. Whenever I hear Americans talk about something being unconstitutional, right, it's very interesting to me. They're talking about it like it's Torah, like it's holy writ. And then you think about, what is the Constitution? It's a document produced by slave owners, by 18th century men, no female participation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, it's a constructed document that becomes the foundation that we don't want to move. And I understand why you don't want to move it. You don't want to move it for the exact reasons that I've been talking about Judaism, which is if you can move it, if you can change it, if you can shift it, then maybe there's nothing there. And it's just what I decide, right? And when you think about raising kids, right, think about your children, and you say, like, well, I'd like them to be Jews like I am a Jew, except it doesn't work out that way. Because just like you changed what your parents did, they're going to change what we did, and so on and so forth. So the question of how to maintain that gravitas and yet adopt, that's the central question of modern Judaism. Every question goes back to that.
How do you put Torah in the matrix?
Depends what you're defining as Torah. If you're defining it as a kind of, I like to talk about Torah as an event versus Torah as a process.
How about just the written words?
Torah as an event versus?
Process, right? Is it just something that was plunked down at Sinai and we just follow it, or is it a process? It's just an idea that keeps getting developed by people. This is beyond our scope here, but when you talk about the written word, so you talk about language, what is language? Who decides what language means, etc., etc.? Like, it all goes into it. Let's take a look at the modern debate about sacred space, which takes us more into the realm of this country presently. A wonderful passage in 7 from Meir Simcha Kohen of Tvinz, known as the Meshech Chachma, also known as the Or Sameach. You recall a seminal passage in the Torah where Moshe comes down from meeting with God at Har Sinai and discovers that the Jewish people have made an eagle, a golden calf, and enraged, he drops the tablets, smashes them down. How could he do that? Isn't this the word of God? Mm-hmm. Are we taking this ontologically holy thing and smashing it on the ground? Right, it's the Meshech Chachma in 7. Everything that is holy, Israel, Jerusalem, is no more than an aspect of the Torah and is sanctified by the holiness of the Torah. Do not imagine that the temple and the sanctuary are holy in and of themselves. God forbid. God dwells amongst his people, and if they transgress his covenant, they, the temple and the sanctuary, are bereft of their holiness and become as profane objects. The tablets bearing the writing of God are also not holy in and of themselves, but only for your sake, meaning the Jewish people. It's only for you that they are holy. And when the bride goes whoring from her canopy, uses an image from Nevi'im here, right, of betrayal of God, right, actually sort of committing adultery, but only for you if you... Sorry, they become no more than pieces of clay. They are not holy in and of themselves, but only for you if you keep the mitzvot engraved upon them. In sum, there is nothing holy in the world. Only God is holy, and it is God who is befitting of praise and worship. Holiness inheres in no created thing, except insofar as the people of Israel keep the Torah in accordance with the will of the Creator, right? So here, he's actually making a radical move in terms of interpreting that story, those verses, to say, you know, before they sinned, when he came down with the tablets, those tablets are holy. And as soon as they basically depart, and betray God and have no interest in monotheism. It's just a bunch of rock. It's just lead, just heavy. There's a beautiful midrash about that, right, where he carries it. When he comes down, it's really, really, really light, and then it becomes too heavy and he drops it, right? Why? Because the letters, says the midrash, fly away. So now it's just rock, right? And it's a wonderful characterization of the idea that things have import when we treat them with import, and when they don't, they're just objects. Now, Renee.
Even though they were broken, they still were holy because they did still keep it in the Aron.
Yes.
All those years
yes.
in the desert.
Yes.
And then when they came to Israel and Shiloh and then to Yerushalayim.
Yes.
So there was some intrinsic value to it.
Or if not intrinsic.
People didn't see it.
Yeah, or if not intrinsic, they conferred upon it.
Right.
A kind of sacred status.
And there was a replacement.
You know, and there was a replacement, right? So the two of them shared the Aron together, right? That's a good point. Yeah. I don't think of it as either one or the other, you know. I don't know that it's necessarily essentially holy or not, but they treated it that way.
Right. It was
they
treated,
wanted
that's,
it
that's
that
what
way.
I wanted to
yeah,
say.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
They didn't just leave it there and cut it.
Correct, correct, correct.
Which
for
they
them,
should have done.
Right, they could have.
You
right.
know, like, do we know what they did with all the manna when it stopped? Do we know what happened with, you know, the water, the whales? They didn't continue the everything.
Right. To me, it's not crucial that there were actually broken tablets that they schlepped around. For all I know, they were gone. It's the idea of keeping those broken tablets. The Gemara actually is a lovely interpretation of the idea of what does it mean to carry on broken tablets. It says that the Talmid Chacham, who is no longer a Talmid Chacham, like has maybe lost his mental faculties, should be treated with respect and sanctity for what that person represented. So there's all sorts of ways of understanding broken tablets, but you're right, they did pick it up, and that is significant. Yes, indeed.
That's the last sentence of this is what it says.
Yeah.
But in the ears.
In
so far as the people of Israel
keep the Torah, right? Yishaiah Leibowitz, who we mentioned before in number 8, leaps upon this idea to put his vote in for functional holiness. He's a modern Israeli philosopher. He talks about the Mishnah we saw in source 3, with 3 lines from the bottom of the page, and he says, "We're not told the land is holy, but that it's sanctified. The crucial point is what its holiness consists of. From it are brought the omer, the first fruits, the 2 loaves, and so on." Let's turn the page. These things are brought not because it is a holy land. We're on page 3 at the top. The land is sanctified by the act of fulfilling the commandments. By contrast with the intrinsic holiness of God, there's no holiness in the world except sanctification through mitzvot. Right. So he definitely voting for the functional definition as opposed to the essentialist one. And now he applies this across the board. So notice Leibowitz, who was in 1968, called for the return of the territories. The return, not negotiation. It wasn't a lefty move. It wasn't politics. He felt morally, it's not yours, just give it back. I don't care who you give it back to. Not interested in any kind of some peace deal. This isn't pro-Palestinian. It's more like, it's not ours, give it back. And he then applies the notion of non-holiness to the political situation and says the following in source 9. "The land of Israel is the holy land, and the Temple Mount is a holy place only by virtue of the mitzvot linked to these locations. These mitzvot were not associated with the land of the mountain because they are holy. On the contrary, their holiness derives from the mitzvot associated with them. The idea that a specific country or location has an intrinsic holiness is an indubitably idolatrous idea." Right? One of the good things about reading Leibowitz is that he gives you one of the poles. Right? Never shy to express himself. He is here laying out ideologically a very firm, unequivocal vote for functionalism, and he's completely willing to articulate what he thinks the ramifications of that position are. If it's functional, it's not inherent, and if you treat it that way, you're turning it into idol worship. You're just worshiping clay. Yeah.
But couldn't you say you need the Temple Mount in order to perform various mitzvot? So even if it's not inherently holy, if mitzvot are so important.
Yes. But the question then would be, on what basis do you keep it, what's involved, and so on. So I don't think he's against the Temple Mount. He's against the notion that what we do and how we do it is because we think the thing is intrinsically holy. But you're right, 100%. You know, Abram Joshua Heschel in the Sabbath in 10 talks about the fact that to be sacred, the thing had to be consecrated by a conscious act of man. The quality of holiness is not in the grain of matter. It is a preciousness bestowed upon things by an act of consecration and persisting in relation to God. Another vote, really, for sanctification as opposed to intrinsic holiness. And interestingly, Rabbi Soloveitchik also seems to ascribe this view, or the kind of middle view or shifting view of history. But he says the following in 11. For them, the Rishonim, the medieval scholars, the attribute of Kedusha holiness ascribed to the land is an objective metaphysical quality inherent in the land. With all my respect for the Rishonim, I must disagree with such an opinion. I do not believe that it is halakhically cogent. Kedusha, under a halakhic aspect, is man-made. More accurately, is a historical category. A soil is sanctified by historical deeds performed by a sacred people, never by any primordial superiority. The halakhic term kedushat ha'aret, sanctity of the land, denotes the consequence of a human act, either conquest or the mere presence of the people in the land. Kedusha is identical with man's association with Mother Earth. Nothing should be attributed a priori to dead matter. Objective Kedusha smacks of fetishism. Interesting, right? So you do have a number of contemporary Jewish scholars who argue for functionalism and argue that talking about inherent holiness in people is really fetishistic or even idolatrous. Now, clearly, here's another side of the coin, and it's to the other side of the coin that we turn. Like, a major influence in the sort of religious Zionist component of this country has been influenced by the counterview of intrinsic holiness and the idea of the sanctity of the land, which pervades their religious ideology and also their political ideology, and we'll turn to them next.
Can I go back to 10 and 11? And I find it, I mean, I see what you're saying, and I see what they're intending with some of the words, but the language they use still seems to undermine their argument. I mean, it still seems to belie a sort of almost a romanticism for an essentialist view. If you look at just Soloveitchik, for example, the soil is sanctified by historic deeds. Okay, so you could take, and then later, sanctity of land denotes the consequence of the human act. So these are things that humans transform. But then once transformed, it sounds like they have the feature, the characteristic of being holy, that you can't back away from.
Right, Andrew, so, yeah.
You know, the language here is it doesn't do the work that they're claiming that it does unless you come up with a different thing. The land isn't sanctified, but our practices are treating the land as if it were sanctified, or some more conditional language, if that's the position they want to take.
No, I think that's a sharp reading, and I think it is left murky. It's left vague, and it comes back to me to the, I don't feel the thought gets finished, right? Are we talking about the car or the bobsled? Once you've done it, does
right.
it stay? Does it return? In other words, does it lapse? Is it what Seth was talking about originally, which is the idea of you've got the cup and the bottle, and it's always there, but in the time that it's not being poured,
Heschel,
what's going on?
Heschel is the best example, but fortunately you only have 3 sentences, so we can't, you know, who knows if you can read those later, but it's by an act of consecration and persisting. So once you stop persisting, then it isn't anymore.
My speculation, and it's just speculation, is that actually people want to have their holiness cake and eat it too.
Yeah.
they really want a sense of it being something you do, but also something that is. And I think that goes back to the other binary I was talking about, which is the idea of a permanent ethos of gravitas versus the necessary changes you have to make. Most things in life people want to feel are both essential, but they also recognize that adjustments have to be made. Even we betray ourselves, and just the ordinary language we use in human life about relationships, about family, about the things that are really most important to us, nobody wants to feel that these are just stuff we do, right? We want to feel like these rituals we have or these relations we have are not just movable, that there's something intrinsically profound about them that can't just be thrown out. At the same time as we mouth that discourse all the time, we recognize that things change, that maybe what we thought was unbreakable becomes breakable because of certain circumstances. I never thought we would be in this position. I always thought that this was sacred in our family, in our country, in our community, in our synagogue, however you want to finish that sentence. And yet I realize now that we have to make adjustments. And we make adjustments because they need to be made, but I think every time we make them, we're left with just a little sense of loss, just a little sense of it's not quite ever going to be quite the same. And that is the dilemma throughout human life, which is how to retain the gravitas and make the necessary adjustments. And I think that what you're picking up on, I think very, very wisely, is there adoption of a position and yet a kind of almost nostalgic yearning or a kind of tribute to the other side. We want that fundamental thing, but that fundamental thing raised to a kind of, worldview becomes a fetish. You know, like we're literally worshiping land, we're worshiping rock, we don't want that. So intellectually, we don't want that. But if it's just what we do, if it's just what we make of it, it just doesn't feel thick enough, robust enough, as a way of life. And that's the paradox that we're caught in. Yes?
Have fun. When we sanctify, the act of burying people is problematic.
Yeah.
And it all comes down to that, like at the end of the day, that you hear that.
Right. Yeah, no. For sure. For sure, what can I say? So I have an odd relationship to Hebron, right? My mother was born in Hebron in 1925. So she's actually a survivor of the Hebron riots of 1929, right? Someone's got her house. Literally. Somewhere in there is my grandfather's house, right? When I went to Hebron, my mother's maiden name is Slonim, right? Which is a well-known name in Israel. And when I went to Hebron, and I went to the cemetery, so you see, all the people my mom talked about, there they are, in the graveyard, right? But on the other hand, so there's something profound there, and yet there's also something disturbing about, practically speaking, the need to, to kind of fetishize this place and what it is, and yes, okay, so there's the Marat Machpelah. Maybe the Avot are buried there, maybe they're not. Symbolically, it's powerful for people. The question of the consequences of maintaining this idea that this place is right, and I've met both kinds. I know people live in Hebron who are utterly invested in the inherent sanctity of the place. I've met people who are appalled by that point of view, right? And that's the great argument here. In the end, though, what you have in Israel today is you just have people living here, just trying to figure out how does all of this cohere, and it's a very, very fractious polity, right? There's a kind of rhetoric that takes place in the diaspora that's in a way a little funny to me, which is the kind of rah-rah, right? When I hear Israel discussed in the diaspora, it's always this weird kind of black-white, these evil, hegemonic, occupying oppressors, or rah-rah for everything that takes place here, the wall, the IDF, da-da-da-da. It's all like that, right? And the reality is, it's just people, living, worrying about their kids, trying to make a living, et cetera, trying to piece together, nobody wakes up in the morning and talks about the matzav, the situation or the occupation. They talk about like getting their kids to school and worrying about being overdrawn at the bank and et cetera, et cetera. So there's just this mounds of rhetoric, right? You know, I don't think most Israelis think about Hebron at all, ever. Right? It's just it's another reality, especially if you live outside of this.
You mean 5% think about it a lot.
Sorry?
You said most. You mean like 95% don't think about it?
95% don't think about it, and certain people think about it a lot, and think about it a lot both because of what it is and also because of what it represents for them. You know? Let's take a look at Rav Kook, right? The legacy of just that idea that we're speaking about. Rabbi Abraham Isaac Kook was the first chief rabbi of Mandate Palestine. He actually was born in Europe, in Eastern Europe, and he only came to Israel at the age of 39. In 1904, where he became the chief rabbi of Jaffa. He was outside of Israel between 1914 and 1919 because he left the country and got stuck during World War I. So if you add up the years, he was actually spent more years in the diaspora than he did in the land of Israel. He died of cancer in 1935. He's the sort of grandfather, godfather, really, of Dati Lumi. He has many, many, many statements that seem to partake of the rhetoric of essential holiness, both regarding Jews and regarding the land of Israel. Just a few sample citations, starting at the bottom of the page with source 12. Land of Israel is an independent entity, tied up with the nation in a living bond, cherished or embraced because of its innate internal qualities. Because of this, it is impossible to categorize the nature of the holiness of the land of Israel and to bring to bear this deep love for her with any rational human insight. This is not a rational category. There is something innate about this land that does not partake of rational discourse, right? He goes on to say, at the bottom of the page, the land of Israel is not some external entity. It's not merely an external acquisition for the Jewish people, not merely a means of uniting the populace. Let's turn the page. Rather, the land of Israel has an intrinsic meaning. It is connected to the Jewish people with the knot of life. Its very being is suffused with extraordinary qualities. He goes on with more rhetoric. The imaginative faculty of the land is lucid and clear. He says the imaginative faculty of the lands of the nations is turbid, mixed with darkness, right? So he's actually talking about how you think here. I don't know if you got over jet lag, whether you think you're thinking clearer now that you're walking in the streets of Jerusalem, but, right? So there's something different, holy, intrinsic, internal, right, through source 12, and so on. So, now you reach a wonderful paradox in the history of Zionism. This supposedly holy, intrinsically holy place, who comes back? Who settles it? Who steers the way to political sovereignty? Secular people. How do you fathom the paradox of secular Zionism if you hold a notion that this is all kind of a religious category? So, hence, a lot of Orthodox Jews, especially in the old Yishuv, Haredim, saw secular Zionism as a contradiction in terms. That's a mild way of putting it. And they saw it as a dark force, a bad thing. You see the residue of that opposition / contempt right up to this day. Rav Kook was unique in some ways in espousing the idea that even secular Zionism can serve religious or divine purposes. How could he do that? The people who are building the land flagrantly did not care about certain essential ritual mitzvot. They were mechal Shabbat, etc., etc. So he came up with an ingenious way of squaring the circle. Let's take a look at a summary of this maneuver by Professor Shlomo Avineri, who has a wonderful book called The Making of Modern Zionism, which I highly recommend. And he's going to talk a little bit about Rav Kook in Source 13. according to Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cook, in the divine cosmic order where every detail has its own place in telos, the true meaning of a person's action may be unknown to himself. He may fancy himself as motivated by A, yet the ultimate meaning of his action may be B. The same applies to the Zionist pioneers. They may subjectively think they are motivated by secular political ideas, but truly, they are acting within a cosmic scheme of a divine will in which their seemingly secular and even atheistic motivation is nothing else than an external cover for the true meaning of their actions related to God's redemptive structure. These people may contribute toward the ultimate messianic coming even while they deny it. They may have to be seen as tools and vessels in the hands of divine providence. Unbeknownst to themselves, they serve the labor of divine. In Rabbi Cook's words, a Jewish nationalist, no matter how secularist his intention may be, despite himself, is imbued with the divine spirit even against his own will. Right? I remember years ago, Amos Oz, very upset about this passage. You know, he felt correctly that it was utterly patronizing. You know, you don't know what you're doing, but actually unknown to you, you're actually serving God's purpose by, you know, building houses here. There is actually a similar trope in the Bible. If you look in Bereshit in chapter 45, at the beginning of Parshat Vayigash, you recall the story that Joseph, kidnapped by his brothers, goes down to Egypt, is brought up from Potiphar's house, serves the Pharaoh, becomes second in command, comes up with a master plan to avert famine. So now everybody has to come down to Egypt, including his family, Yaakov's sons, his brothers. They come, he recognizes them, they don't recognize him. In chapter 45 of Genesis comes the great revelation scene where Joseph reveals himself to his brothers. And what does he say there? They're like stunned. I mean, I always imagine this almost like the Godfather. Right? He comes to them and he says, Ani Yosef, Oda Vichai. In the back of my head, for some reason, it's always like Brando. You know? I'm Joseph. His daddy's still alive. And it must be terrifying, right? Because for all they know, he is going to lower the boom on them. Like, you guys, you know what you did to me? But just fascinatingly and shockingly, it takes a completely other turn. We know it went well, but if you're reading the text prospectively, we just stopped at Pasuk Gimel of Perek Mem Hei, you'd be like, uh-oh, what's about to happen? And then he does this really quote-unquote magnanimous thing. He says, don't worry, don't concern yourselves. God brought me here to save you alive. Right? I was, in other words, you're kidnapping me as part of this great providential plan so that I would end up here, so that I would avert the famine for everybody. That's cooking it. He's taking their action. You know, they certainly did not do it because they wanted to avert famine. They did it because they couldn't stand him. And they wanted to get rid of him. Right? Yeah, we can talk. That's a whole other issue, what's going on in this passage. I also think there's something slightly nefarious, but he is basically taking the view that no matter what human beings do, almost like rats in a maze, there's this master plan going on. You're not even aware of it. You thought that you moved to Tulsa because of a job, but it turned out that God wanted you there because of X. Right? That's Rev Cook's view about secular Zionism. They think that they're just building the land because they want a place to, you know. But they aren't, because God is, in a way, using them in the providential sense to create his purposes, whatever that means.
Can holiness be, in Rev Cook, then a second priority? In other words, one of the arguments that he used here was that... That these people were too busy trying to construct the state of Israel to worry about kosher and all of these things, and that we just have to give them a little bit of time, and once we've created the state of Israel, then they will have plenty of time. So, you know, you are not holy today, but through what you're doing, you will eventually realize that you are going to be holy.
I would say, Juan, that it's undoubtedly true what you're saying. I think that he had faith or belief that, you know, or at least a goal that So they're not there yet, but, you know, they'll do this, and we'll bring them along, and we'll try and influence them. And, you know, he wasn't blocked.
Like I do with my children.
Yeah, you know, I mean, he wasn't blocked at the point of attack and saying, you know, well, you are who you are, so you're useless. We can't, you know. It was more like, so there's something beautiful about that. I mean, there's an openness. But as Oz argued, it's an openness that's condescending. In other words, you're not really respecting the actual truth of my choices, which is that I actually reject the tradition. I do what I do. I don't feel like I need to be manipulated to be as a kind of pawn in the divine game. But I think, as Zavineri is arguing here, that for Rav Kook, this was actually a way of trying to understand how do you square the provenance of history, that it turns out we've come back to the Holy Land, and who's leading the charge? Not religious people. You know, not at all.
I don't think it's so black and white. If you go to Ben-Gurion's in Tel Aviv, he had a little Mishnah. I mean, incredibly well read and knew all that. And the whole thing with the Charetim, where he let them learn, he like acknowledged the fact that this should happen and they should serve in the army. There was a sort of mutual respect. It was sort of more like, not for me. But I don't know if it's an actual rejection.
So you're right, but it's an historical development. In other words, the people he's dealing with, the farmers at that time, are fairly radically secular. That influx of European Jews who are not necessarily like, you know, dotted I cross T shomrei mitzvot, but have a healthy respect for the tradition, that's slightly later, and you're absolutely right. That is, and that's a crucial piece of Israeli culture, because that sort of piece diminished after a certain point, but that's a whole other discussion. Yeah.
And it seems to me Kook is also responding to the initial reaction of the Nazi, which was opposed to any kind of development.
Yeah.
And Kook is already late to the historical development of this. I also don't understand, you know, don't let reason apply to this. If he's applying all this reason to explain what's happening.
We don't want to be utterly irrational in our irrationality. Now, the legacy, however, of Rav Kook is complicated because, of course, he does die pre-Shoah, pre-state. It's a favorite, but in my opinion, foolish game of speculating history. That, you know, what would Rav Kook say about Gush Emunim? What would Rav Kook say about X, Y? I really don't know, you know. But what does happen is that his son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, becomes more ideological in terms of the relationship of the land to holiness, and hence the political ramification of dividing it at all. It's a very striking speech that Rav Tzvi Yehuda, his son, gives just before the Six-Day War. And what is Rav Tzvi Yehuda talking about? He's lamenting what took place 19, 20 years earlier. Look what he writes in Source 14. 19 years ago, on the night when the news of the United Nations decision in favor of the reestablishment of the State of Israel reached us, when the people streamed into the streets to celebrate and rejoice, I could not go out and join in the jubilation. I sat alone and silent. A burden lay upon me. During those first hours, I could not resign myself to what had been done. I could not accept the fact that they indeed, and here he quotes a pasuk from Yoel, they have divided my land, unquote. Yes, and now, after 19 years, where is our Chevron? Have we forgotten her? Right, because remember, this is prior to the war. Right? And all that lies beyond, where is our Shechem, our Yericho? Where? Have we forgotten them? And all that lies beyond the Jordan? Each and every clod of earth, every region, hill, valley, every plot of land that is part of the land of Israel, have we the right to give up even one grain of the land of God? Right here is the nexus between holiness and politics. On that night, 19 years ago, during those hours, as I sat trembling in every limb of my body, wounded, cut, torn to pieces, I could not then rejoice. That's a very significant piece of discourse in understanding the mindset and the ideology of those who share it. Right? I've often said that if the Palestinians and the Israelis sat down and they were completely trusting and they were open and they made peace, The next morning would be a catastrophic crisis for this kind of religious audience. Catastrophic. Because you would no longer have, and in some sense, all of the inability to make peace serves as a very convenient fig leaf for not having to give everything up. We can't give them land, they're not trustworthy, they're going to fire rockets. What happens if that wasn't true? Take all that away and just say, there are no bullets, everybody's laid down their arms. Are you going to give up the land? It's a Yehuda, it would be a disaster. No, no, we can't. So now the bluff is called. You mean you won't even if they're peaceful? No, no, we can't. Right? We can't. Right? So it's a very interesting kind of intersection between a religious ideology and its ramification for the political. Now, I tend to think that the Dati Lumi world, which I intersect with quite a lot, is a much more complicated place than it is sort of advertised outside. There's lots of shades, there's lots of people who have various ways of thinking about it. There are many people who are not hardline Kochians, who actually don't believe in the ideology, etc., etc., etc. But in its purest form, for those people who adhere to it in its purest form, this is a classic representation of what happens when what seems to be an academic issue, right, now takes flight in a real-life political struggle. If you think this land is holy, every clot is very plain here. How can you give it up? It's not a real-world, realpolitik position at all. It's a mythic position. We have a holy land, it's ours, the rest be damned. And hence, you know, the very things that perplex people from the outside, what the hell are you doing setting up that caravan like 50 miles east of, like, way into, you know, quote-unquote occupied territory? That's the whole point. That is the whole point. This isn't accidental. This is ours. And I want to show that every clod of land is mine.
So, two questions. On the other side of this political argument, one, they could disarm this by saying, sure, there'll be a Palestinian state. You can live in your trailer up there. I mean, does Rav Kook's son want require that to be a sovereign political entity, or that a Jew could live there?
That's a great question. It's one that's actually debated in certain circles in the religious Zionist community. Would we prefer to live in, you know, the territory under Palestinian rule? There are some people I've actually met who said they would prefer that. But it's definitely not a settled question. You had a second question.
And if they knew that they could disarm us by saying that if they had peace, that might bring people to peace. Why are they not trying? Why has their attitude been more belligerent than disarming
the Palestinian attitude?
Right.
Because as Abba even said, they never miss an opportunity.
Yeah, but to me, yes. So I said to Phil a long time ago, I said, if there's a state, why would it have to be Judenrein?
You know, right, so that's, these are all good questions.
Yeah, because, I mean, so the thing is, what I'm saying is Rav Kook, he's saying is, the land is ours, every clod, Jewish people. He's not saying the state of Israel must have that. You think that?
Right. I'm not a Tzvi Yehuda expert, I would tend to argue that I don't think he conceived of this as Palestinian land in which Jews would live.
I think he definitely thought of it as
total sovereignty. Yeah, absolutely. Right. And it's worth pointing out, again, I want to state that this position...
When did he write that?
He wrote that in 1967. Right? He spoke it. It was a speech he gave a few weeks before the Six-Day War.
Oh, that's right.
That's
part of the messianism.
Absolutely. Absolutely part of the messianism. But again, it is not a unanimous, uniformly held view whatsoever. There's a lot of divide and fractiousness in that community about issues like this. It's often sort of tarred with one brush from the outside. It's inaccurate. Sir?
Yeah, and so the question's really struggling between what it means to own the land and the difference between property ownership and state sovereignty or control over it.
Right.
And he seems not to be defining or getting at those issues, but if it really is ownership of the land, control of the land, then it raises a much more radical and problematic issue. What do you do with the Arabs? Not what can Jews live under Arabs, but can Arabs or non-Jews live here at all? I mean, that is what the, not live here, but own property
Yeah, no, it's all up for grabs. It's all discussed, everything from Mirakahani's plan to expel them to the idea that they would live here, but, you know, under our domain, to the idea that they would live here not under our domain, and everything.
Just don't think you can bracket the one without thinking.
Correct, I agree. I agree. Similar statement that he made later on in Source 15, again, Rips Vito Cook, the whole of this country is ours. It belongs absolutely to all of us, and it cannot be given over to others. The inheritance of our father Abraham, Pasuk from Shmot, from Bereshit, to thy seed will I give this land. That's a typo. It should be Genesis 12:7. Therefore, there can once and for all be no possible doubt. Let's turn over. Here might answer a bit of your question. No doubt that there are no Arab territories and Arab lands here. Only Jewish lands. The eternal inheritance of our forefathers on which others came and built without our permission or presence, right? So Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda's position is they occupied us. Right? And we never left or were separated from the inheritance of our forefathers. We everlastingly continued to protest against their cruel and artificial control of the land. So we are commanded to liberate our lands and never to relinquish them. The whole land, according to all the biblical borders, belongs to and comes under the rule of the people of Israel. Yes, ma'am.
So if you're talking about biblical forefathers, which is here, inheritance, what was promised to Abraham goes all the way to the Euphrates.
You bet.
I mean, why don't we say, you know, Jordan, I don't know, even I'm really bad on the map, but, you know, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran, blah, blah, blah. Are those
kadosh? Yeah, so Renee, you're raising a very important point, which is really, I teach this as a completely separate class,
okay,
which is
no,
what are actually the borders, what are the borders of Israel?
Right.
It's a huge biblical argument. There are successive iterations in the Bible that are different, actually. There's minimal, there's maximalist. How does it work politically? You know, it's a mess.
No, but what I'm saying is, we lived there in Babylon as an exile.
Yeah.
Was it Kadosh there without any Mikdashim?
Right.
And all the years like now, nobody's living there.
Right.
Do any of these rabbis that you're talking about, even from Rambam on or even previous, talk about that being Kadosh?
Well, the question of the holiness of a place outside of Israel where Jews do sanctified acts, so does Pittsburgh become holy when we do sanctified acts in Pittsburgh, right? So, from their point of view, probably not in the same way, you know. There is sanctity to the things you do, but does the state of Pennsylvania become inherently holy? Probably.
In terms of Renee's question, doesn't the Gemara discuss even in terms of Maser and Truma? There are much narrower limits.
Right.
In the Gemara with respect to that.
Right. And that's Yishai Leibowitz's view. Leibowitz is really taking the minimalist view. The Talmud says that over here, this is what we do here and nowhere else, and
but
therefore that's what makes this.
But even in terms of defining the borders, clearly it's not, they talk, I don't know if it's the other side of Jordan, but there's a questionable area.
Yeah.
I'm saying, you can clearly say there's a traditional Jewish view that it's not so broad.
Yeah, but here specifically mentioned the inheritance of our forefathers. So which forefathers is he talking about? Is he going back to Abraham, or is he talking about Moses and Yahushua?
It's conveniently vague.
Again.
So a good example of somebody, Rav Zalman Baruch Melamed in Source 16, Rav Shiva Beit El, the heart of that movement, writing about inherent holiness, says, electricity is a power we all know exists, and we all know the effect it has, but all the same, it cannot be seen. Similarly, holiness has a reality of its own. It may not be seen or felt, but it affects objects, places, and time. In fact, the root of all existence is holiness. So there is clearly an argument here going on counter the view we saw before, where things are functionally holy, right? Mati Imbari, in his book, Messianic Religious Zionism Confronts Israeli Territorial Compromises, excellent book, Source 17, points out that Merkaz HaRav followers, those people who are in that tradition of the cooks, emphasizing two key concepts, holiness of the land, holiness of the state. According to the junior cook, the land of Israel, comprised of land within the 48 borders, territories acquired in 1967. And here, Renee, to get your point, even Transjordan is one unit, a complete organic entity imbued with its own will and holiness, connected and united with the entire Jewish people, present, past, and future, so that the people in the land are in complete oneness. No one has a right to give away a part of the land. It's a mystical view, right? It's a mythical, mystical view. And when it inheres with real-world politics, it's very volatile and potentially quite toxic. Right?
How many people even hold that?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know quantitatively. You know, part of the problem whenever we talk about what Jews think or Jews do is that we have notoriously bad social science. We don't really have data on anything. We have people say things like, all these Jews are defecting from Judaism. They're going off the derech, or whatever words people use. We don't have studies. We really don't. We don't have, like, good quantitative data. We have some studies in this country about that phenomenon. We have notoriously bad studies in the diaspora about it. We really, like, just rudimentary social science in terms of how to study all of these phenomena that we talk about. You know, Jews are religious, they became not religious, Jews think this, Jews think that. We really are just embryonic in that sense. So I don't know how many people hold this view. Enough people to make a difference. Enough people to have an impact, right? I open up the paper this morning. What does it say? Or yesterday? Bill in Knesset to make Jerusalem undividable by law, right? That's a manifestation. That's a manifestation of part of these views, right? Just like the wall issue. It's fascinating to me, like, every time you open the paper and you see separate issues, they all come back. They all come back to the same thing, right? Okay.
Excuse me, can I just...
Of course you can.
Reading the Inbar, it just seems to me there's an extra element, which is, it's one thing to say we should have everything because it has its inherent holiness, but then you could say, well, that may not be true, but once we've been given it, perhaps by God's, you know, by God, then we can't give it back.
Yeah, so the thing there is, one of the criteria for maintaining something, right, you were the one who pointed out quite accurately, that we do have verses in the Bible that talk about vomiting out, right, the peoples. It seems to me that turnabout is fair play, that if the Bible is setting up a moral paradigm of that you have to act in a certain way to merit being here, how does that paradigm play out in modern Israel? I've always been very fascinated by this. In other words, is the land of Israel the promise to the Jews that's made to Abraham in the forefathers, is it conditional or unconditional? Meaning, he makes a promise to the forefathers and says, I will give this to your offspring. Really? No matter what we do? No matter how we behave? No matter how we carry on our affairs? Very hard question to answer, right? Is it conditional? Is it unconditional? So there are people who've discussed this, right? Professor Eliezer Schweig from the Philosophy Department of Hebrew U has written about this very compellingly, whether it's conditional or unconditional, but the question of whether it's just what God gives to the forefathers and foremothers, is it carte blanche, or are there rules that border it? Like, if I act in a certain way, I forfeit being here, right? So I don't know the answer to that question, but it seems to me, from a biblical point of view, important. Look, I was always never that comfortable with people getting up and saying, you know why it's my land? Because it says in the Bible. Because if you don't share that as your frame of reference, so it's not going to be compelling for you, you know. But I waive that and I say, that's my frame of reference, what does it mean?
No, but I'm saying it's not the Bible. It's that messianic view of 67. That, in other words, it's not like we had to go out and conquer it. We had to go out and conquer it. It's that if it fell into our laps, and perhaps that's the hand of God, isn't that like slapping him in the face to say, now we're going to give it back? But what I see your argument partly saying is, well, even if that's the case, what is the moral position we need to take to deserve?
That's one issue. That's one issue. There's a moral issue of whether it's unconditional or conditional.
Right.
To me, there's a deeper issue that you've touched upon here that we definitely do not have time for. But the question of whether you think God acts in history, you know? And do you think about that selectively, right? People are very good at talking about God selectively in history. You know, they'll talk about the Six-Day War and they'll say, it was definitely the divine hand, maybe. But I would like to know, to the person who argues that, and do you think it was the divine hand in Auschwitz? And God was there too? Is it better if he's there, or is it better if he's not there? I actually think that question is a central question for all Jews. Ask yourself, in any given situation, do you prefer to think that God was involved or not involved? In any given situation, people usually like to have God involved for the stuff they like, and somehow it was in absentia for the stuff they don't like. So when you talk about reactions to the Six-Day War, like it fell into our lap, God must have wanted it. Okay, maybe.
Mike said we'll know that in 100 years. Depends how it plays out.
If.
If.
You but know. You began the topic by saying the conundrum for Jews is that if God's so elusive, if God's so far away from us, then it's just only in our hands. Just go, I don't know, go vote, go to work, and but we've given all kinds of tools to call out, so there must be some reason to be calling out.
Look, we create the God we want. We manipulate verses in the way we want. There's almost no Jewish issue at all that doesn't bespeak of different positions in the classical sources, mm-hmm. right? The most mythical line in Jewish education is the preface Judaism says.
Oh.
A more accurate thing would be to say there are sources in Judaism that say X and there are sources in Judaism that say Y. My job is really not to advocate for one or the other, but simply to say that most of these arguments are complex and also have important ramifications for all of Jewish life, everyday Jewish life, in a whole variety of ways. I can no longer pick up the newspaper or turn on the radio, which I do increasingly less, without being reminded of just fundamentally what does all this mean in some kind of meta way. I want to just point out, we have a few minutes remaining, that the issue of the holiness of the land is, of course, challenged by politics itself. So on the one hand, you know, you were talking about 67 falling to our lap. What happens, how does a religious Zionist think about the holiness of the land when it comes to the disengagement in 2005? Is this a reversal? Is God there too, right? Etc. So that was a crisis in religious Zionism.
Could you be a sensualist and give it up for the bigger picture anyway?
Good question.
Good
question.
I
don't think so. I think you could be functionalist and give it up for the bigger picture. But I don't know. I don't know. Well, because most of Jewish ethics is a cluster of values that you have to weigh out, right? In most situations, ethically, are not good versus bad. They're good versus good. So you have to decide which good triumphs, right? So if you have pikuach nefesh on the one hand, and you have sovereignty or holiness of the land on the other one, you have to decide which one outweighs which one is real, which one is less real, and so on. You're always weighing off these decisions. If you look at the bottom of the page, just briefly on this point, in source number 19, right? This is a piece by Tomer Persico, who's a very thoughtful writer here in Israel. He says, the Gush Emunim messianic paradigm, source 19 at the bottom of page 5, was profoundly challenged by the Oslo process and the surge of interest in the Mount. The final crushing blow to the Cook-based messianic approach was probably delivered by the Israeli withdrawal from the Gaza Strip in 2005 and the destruction of the Gush Katif settlements there. The Gush Emunim narrative, is on top of page 6, which talks about unbroken redemption and the impossibility of retreat, encountered an existential crisis. Many religious Zionists are thus turning toward the Temple Mount in place of the belief in step-by-step progress. State consciousness is abandoned along with the patience needed for graduated progress towards redemption. In their place come partisan messianism and irreverent efforts to hasten the messianic era for apocalypse now. He's pointing out, interestingly, there was a surge in pro-temple, let's go up there, consciousness in the religious Zionist community. Right? Because before that, most of the rhetoric in the religious community is that this is a forbidden space. It's not allowed to go up there. And since Gush Katif, there's been a notable surge in the desire to ascend the Temple Mount, almost as the last vestige of getting there, wherever there is.
I just wanted to say one thing, because I live here in Israel, and I was here during that time, and from teenage kids who went to illegally protest, to adults, to whatever, and then I was in Soma, I lived in Manana, where they had the puff, and was it Bibi? But it came down to the fact it was the end of August, and my kids went back to a religious school in September, and the teachers, who were probably mid-30s to 40s, some, they didn't even live in these communities. They were so affected because their rabbis believed that they would not till the last second, that they would not be disengaged. And they were morally crushed.
Yeah, they were crushed down. So
they were crushed, and they needed psychological help.
It was devastating. It wasn't just devastating in terms of the loss of the territory, but it was it was like your
I didn't even want them to teach my kids that
The tooth fairy doesn't exist. You know, it was a fundamental betrayal of what you think is real. The residue continues.
But you mentioned that before. Continues. There are many people who say that that territory wasn't even within the bounds of the biblical Israel, let's call it.
It wasn't.
Yeah, I don't think, but because those people don't really parse it that carefully. It's part of a mythic picture about, you know, what we're supposed to be, what our lives are, what God wants for us, what our sovereignty is, and it all gets kind of put together. I just want to point out, and we're not going to go through it, but I want to just point out what's in the rest of the sources here. I was interested in the idea of what I call Israel of fantasy versus reality on the rest of page 6 and into page 7. Right? The truth is that this country exists as a fantasy for most people historically. In pre-modern times, it was difficult to come here. The journey was so perilous that people didn't come. And in modern times, people don't come either. I mean, the biggest aliyah usually comes from persecution, whether you talk about the former Soviet Union, Ethiopia, pockets of spike in aliyah from places like France or Argentina. But the statistics vis-a-vis safe places in the West, America, Canada, etc., are staggeringly consistent. You know, 2,000 to 3,000 a year, every year. A little bit of a spike maybe after the economic crisis of 2008. Imagine people coming here because they think they'll make money. And the reason is very simple, because in the history of emigration and immigration, the pattern is always you go from what's less prosperous to more prosperous. That's true of all immigrations. There are numerous studies that point this out. So it's counterintuitive to think that you would come here, except if you have, you know, ideological reasons or other kinds of reasons. So mostly, when we talk about Israel, we're talking about a fantasy. We're talking about something in the mind. That was definitely true in the Middle Ages, where people fantasized. If you look at maps of the Middle Ages, this is very intriguing. Israel's the center of the earth. The actual cartographer depiction, right?
More than Israel, Jerusalem.
Right, Jerusalem is the center of the center, right? And the temple is the center of the center of the center. And even rabbinic rhetoric about how amazing this place is. We'll just end with these four examples, right? Take a look at the bottom of page 6, source 23, about 10 lines up. A man is safer in a pit filled with scorpions and snakes in the land of Israel than in the opulent palaces of a foreign land. This was actually commenting on Yosef being thrown in the pit. Safer in apparent physical danger in the land of Israel than in circumstances which appear physically secure outside the land. All right, so this is Rav Chaim of Volozhin. Number two, in the diaspora, bottom of the page, whoever increases its settlement by establishing a home adds to the destruction of the worship of God. But in the land of Israel, the same work is considered a mitzvah since it settles the land. Turn over. That was the Chatam Sofer, or Moshe Sofer. 25. It seems to me in our present peaceful existence outside the land of Israel that we have found another Eretz Yisrael in Jerusalem, and this, to me, is the greatest, deepest, and most obvious and direct cause of all the awesome, frightening, monstrous, unimaginable destruction that we have experienced in the diaspora, i.e. we've gotten very comfortable and we've turned it into the New Jerusalem. That's Rav Yaakov Emden. And 26, the Meshech Chachma we saw before. If a Jew will forget his origin.
I didn't say number 25. He's saying is, since we have made
that is the
Germany,
yes, that's New Jerusalem, that's the cause of our impending destruction. If a Jew will forget his origin and true identity, consider himself a full-fledged citizen of the country of his exile, if he thinks that Berlin is Jerusalem, it's kind of eerie, it's a few decades before the Shoah, then a raging storm will uproot him by his trunk. The tempest will arise and spread its roaring waves and swallow and destroy and spread forth without pity. Now, my point here is in the bold print. None of the above rabbis ever settled in or even visited Israel. It's an imaginative construct in so many ways for people, which is why so much of the rhetoric about it is iffy. Because when you imagine something, as Levinas pointed out, when you encounter the other, it's not the same as just thinking about it in your head. All right, that concludes our session this morning. Thanks very much.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.